You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider, featuring book reviews authored by critics from the New York Times. Yoko, The Biography, by David Sheff. The book cover has a headshot of a young Yoko Ono, subtly smiling with long dark hair and a black hat. The reviewer is Alexandra Jacobs. Yoko Ono, demonized no longer. David Sheff's new biography convincingly argues for John Lennon's widow as a feminist, activist, avant-garde artist, and world-class sass. There is a picture of a black-and-white photograph of Yoko Ono in a wool sweater standing amongst three pedestal displays of her artwork. The caption reads, "Yoko Ono in 1967, with examples of her artwork." Here's the thing about Yoko Ono, the artist and widow of the murdered rock star John Lennon, usually not identified in that order, and the subject of David Sheff's new biography. She is funny. Ha-ha funny, not peculiar funny. Asked by an interviewer if she'd ever forgive Lennon's killer, Mark David Chapman, since Pope John Paul II had visited the jail of his own would-be assassin to offer absolution, Ono replied, "I am not the Pope." Promoting an ephemeral Museum of Modern Art exhibit in 1971, in part to protest the underrepresentation of women and Asian people there, she posed in front with a strategically placed shopping bag so that the building signage read, "Museum of Modern F in brackets Art." This was years before Family Guy. Elton John recounted in his memoir, Me, how he'd wondered why Ono had sold the herd of Holstein cows she'd bought trying to invest ethically. "All that mooing," she told him. For Ono, now 92 and mostly out of the public eye, to have written her own Me would have been profoundly out of character. Her art was crowdsourced long before that was a word. Self-portrait was a mirror in a manila envelope that reflected the viewer. She invited audiences to step on a painting, play a form of the child's game, telephone, climb into a bag, cut off her clothing, or otherwise finish her visions. Following Lennon's death in 1980, trusted intimates flouted confidentiality agreements, stole the couple's memorabilia, and wrote tell-alls that Ono fought hard to suppress. "Best book I'll ever burn," their son Sean told one particularly egregious betrayer in court. Long racistly reviled as the dragon lady who broke up the Beatles, Ono has enjoyed a reputational spiffing in the 2020s. In the luscious documentary The Beatles Get Back, she is mostly Where's Waldo-like in the frame, but occasionally wails into the mic as the bandmates jam. There have been retrospectives of her own art as a participant of the Fluxus movement and beyond at the Japan Society and Tate Modern. Sheff is a prolific journalist and author who conducted one of the last significant interviews with John and Yoko for Playboy and became good friends with her. His memoir, Beautiful Boy, about his son's methamphetamine addiction, was named with her blessing for one of Lennon's last songs. Having received her astrological and numerological clearance, he became enough of a regular at the Dakota to see the changing of the slipcovers from denim in winter to white linen in summer. There have been other biographies of Ono, most recently by the critic Donald Brackett. But with cooperation from her children and brother, her ex-husband Tony Cox, her former partner and decorator Sam Havitoy, her stepson Julian Lennon, colleagues from the arts and music worlds, and such longtime friends as the feminist writer Kate Millett, Sheff's is the closest to an authorized biography the world will get. The book is predictably sympathetic, but not fawning, mostly written in a straightforward prose with sentences like, "The oppression of women by men was the subject of many of her songs, films, writing, and artworks." And yet, sympathy for Ono seems wholly justified. As a woman, she wasn't just dismissed, the art dealer Mary Boone tells Chef. She was demonized. Yoko, meaning ocean child, was born in 1933 in Tokyo to wealthy but cold parents. She didn't meet her father until she was 2½, and her mother was vain and germophobic. Even now, I find it unpleasant to sit on a cushion or chair that still retains the temperature of somebody who had just been sitting there, Ono once wrote. At 12, she watched bombs falling in Tokyo. After evacuation to the countryside, she had to beg and barter for food, take care of her siblings, and suffer through pleurisy and other ailments. There would be suicide attempts and time in a mental hospital. After the war, Ono dropped out from both a philosophy program at Gakushuin University and the Boho Sarah Lawrence College. The journalist, Betty Rollin, a classmate there, found her someone without mooring, drifting, lost and striving. Ono's finishing school would be Greenwich Village, her musical god, not Elvis Presley, but John Cage. She married twice before Lennon to Toshi Ichiyanagi, a Juilliard pianist, and Cox, an art promoter who fathered her daughter, Kyoko, who she took on stage as a baby as an instrument, an uncontrollable instrument, you know, and from whom she was long estranged. Many of her artistic experiments now seem prescient, like offering shares of herself at $250 each. Long before Maurizio Cattelan duct-taped a banana to a wall, she made apple, a piece of fresh fruit on a stand at the Indica Gallery in London. Lennon, naughtily and biblically, took a chomp. I am not an onophile who wants to wallow overmuch in this kind of art, but applaud Chef's book as an important corrective to years of bad PR. He's done the opposite of a hatchet job, putting his subject back together, branch by branch, like a forester. Climbing trees is a big theme in her work. He argues convincingly for her as a survivor, feminist, avant-gardist, political activist, and world-class sass. When people criticized her for licensing Instant Karma to Nike in 1987, she retorted, I got $800,000, which went to the United Negro College Fund. You have a problem with that? The internet in particular seemed built for Ono's participatory visions. When Donald Trump was first elected in 2016, she tweeted a 19-second audio clip of herself screaming. The reviewer, Alexandra Jacobs, reviews all kinds of books for the New York Times Book Review, but is often drawn to life writing, which includes biography, memoir, letters, essays, and some fiction. The Colony by Annika Norlin, translated by Alice E. Olson. The book cover is a pale blue and has a black ant in the middle of it. The reviewer is Jumana Khatib. Is this mysterious Swedish commune an Eden or a nightmare? Annika Norlin's novel, The Colony, follows a group of misfits in a bucolic forest. The only thing its members share is a dark past. There is a graphic art picture of a giant pine branch with an attached pine cone being held up overhead by 8 gray silhouetted figures. Imagine you're an adult orphan, a rootless Hungarian man raised in Sweden, whose greatest emotional connection is with a charismatic criminal. Let's say she drags you to a remote settlement in the Swedish forest at the invitation of a woman she met in prison, who's currently defrauding the state while raising a motherless teenager more or less as her own. Suppose enough time goes by that you live there now, and the only living soul in whom you can safely confide your doubts is a chicken named Dr. Snuggles. This is just one strand of Annika Norlin's first novel, The Colony, a disturbing, engrossing portrait of a tiny community living beyond society. They're an incongruous group, each so physically distinct, it's clear to any onlooker they belong to no traditional social unit like family or a team of loggers. Among their ranks, the orphan man, Joseph, his partner, Sarah, who was imprisoned for extreme animal rights protests and exerts a dark magnetism over her peers. Her friend from jail, Agony, a formidable maternal woman who murdered her husband. Her young charge, a beatifically handsome man on the run from the authorities. An aunt specialist who despises the son she delivered on the premises, and that child himself. Together, they bring a staggering amount of violent history and psychological torment to this glorious mountain setting, where they fall into such harmonious rhythm that they hardly need to speak. Their days are governed by work, and they have almost no contact with outsiders. But there are plenty of foraged berries, roast perch from the nearby lake, swabbed with butter, and nights spent sleeping together under a sprawling, quasi-matriarchal tree they call the Big Spruce. No wonder they take care to give thanks for everything they ingest, kill, or saw down. Depending on your perspective, this could be an Edenic laboratory of human cooperation, everyone occupying a role suited to their talents, their biological needs more or less met, or a band of vulnerable individuals in thrall to a manipulative despot whose will is so strong it eclipses all prior conceptions of fairness, law, and reason. Meaning that unwanted little boy who spends his formative years living in the woods deserved a proper education and doctor's visits and regular socialization with his peers. We meet the group through Emily, a freelance journalist overcome by such paralyzing burnout that she leaves her city life for a tent in the woods. Soon into her stay, she spots the colony, who are settled nearby. Starved for companionship and a simpler existence, she's moved by the rituals of care they perform for one another. "I noticed that I had tears in my eyes," she writes in her notebook, a bodily memory of what it was like to be little and held. Her observations are intercut with chapters focusing on each of the colony's members in the past and present. Norlin is in full command of her characters' histories and marshals a tremendous level of detail, particularly surrounding Joseph and Agony. A sad little boy hollowed out by his parents' experiences during the Holocaust, Joseph grows up well-liked but a loner, and eventually leads a church choir. When he meets Sarah there, she warms a side of himself that has never before felt sunlight. For all her physical strength, Agony has been broken by a dismissive, mentally ill mother and an uncouth husband who left her for another woman. It's crushing to learn her reason for casting off her given name, Oline, and adopting Agony instead. "I wanted to come first, for once." When you sense the alphabet is someone's only ally, is it so hard to imagine the appeal of a fiercely loyal insular clan? The novel covers 2 decades of the colony's existence, enough time for nearly every member to suffer a privately unbearable period and imagine living outside the group's perimeter. It's been 1,286 days without sex. Soon I'll dry up completely. I find myself relating to the potatoes, Agony thinks at one point, and it had been a really bad year for potatoes. It is a delicate balancing act, designing the inner lives of 8 distinct characters alongside their shared mythology. The colony was the vessel, and sometimes they could see in each other's faces which way things were headed. Now the ship is about to capsize. Someone must go stand on the other side to restore balance, Norlin writes, summoning the collective mood and its hold on them. One thing they often said to each other was how lucky they were to live like this. My admiration of the colony is equally an appreciation for Alice E. Olson, whose work to bring the story into English is so precise and vibrant that I often forgot I was reading a translation. Too often, novels packed with this many ideas sacrifice emotion in favor of mounting a ponderous argument. Norlin instead writes visceral episodes that speak for themselves. How to sever an umbilical cord in the forest? With your teeth. The story's open-ended questions about the power of charisma and love and the boundaries between the individual and the greater good arise organically without forcing stale answers. The book's ending may strike some as a bit pat, though it helps to remember that ant colonies are known to make group decisions for the benefit of their population. As for Dr. Snuggles, once she got too old to be useful, they chopped her up and cooked her with sauce. The reviewer, Jumana Khatib, is a book editor and writes a weekly newsletter about literature, along with reviews and author profiles, contributing regularly to the Read Like the Wind newsletter, and often joins her colleagues on the Book Review podcast. Tilt by Emma Patti. The book cover has a small bird with a red breast and head and black wings standing and facing left. The title, Tilt, is also tilted at an angle. The reviewer is Alexis Shatkin. 9 months pregnant and navigating the apocalypse. Emma Patti's debut novel, Tilt, takes place in the 24 hours after the really big one devastates the Pacific Northwest. The most read New Yorker article of 2015 was Catherine Schultz's The Really Big One, about the potentially devastating Cascadia earthquake that has a 1 in 3 chance of striking the Pacific Northwest within the next 40 years. Taking this very real threat as its knockout premise, Emma Patti's debut novel, Tilt, is a moving adrenaline rush that also manages to be very funny. When the really big one hits, Annie, who narrates the novel as if addressing her unborn child, Bean, is 37 weeks pregnant and shopping for a crib at IKEA in Portland, Oregon. Tilt takes readers through the next 24 hours with chapters that flash back to fill in the details of Annie's life. Annie and her husband, Dom, are star children who forgot to become stars. Annie, once a promising playwright, supports them as the office manager at a tech company, while Dom auditions for acting roles and picks up shifts at a cafe. Financially strapped, creatively stifled, and increasingly distant, Annie and Dom are, if not on the path to breaking up, at least able to see the path to breaking up from where we're standing. But when Annie emerges from the rubble of IKEA, all she can think of is finding Dom, and so she embarks on a journey across the ravaged city. In the summer heat, swollen and dehydrated, Annie trudges past collapsed bridges and burning houses, looted shops and leveled schools. Along the way, she crosses paths with others in their own dire circumstances, most memorably an IKEA employee named Taylor, some of whose fates we will learn, some of whom the narrative will leave behind as Annie presses on. The ingredients in Tilt are familiar. A bit of Emily St. John Mandel's Station 11, Theater Kids in the Apocalypse, and a bit of Rumaan Alam's Leave the World Behind, Cutting Social Observation in the Apocalypse. The acerbic takes on marriage and motherhood, reminiscent of Ashley Audrain and Rachel Yoder. Shaken together, these ingredients make for a potent cocktail. I cried more than once reading it. The book's cover image, a small model bird, comes from an anecdote about Annie's late mother's unrealized artistic ambitions that is as heartbreaking as any of the tragic scenes Annie encounters on her journey. I also laughed out loud at many of her dark, unfiltered thoughts, like this one. I read somewhere that in the case of a natural disaster, you should not look strangers in the eye in case they die later and you're forced to eat them. Readers' mileage with Annie may vary. Her emotions are often dialed up to 11, not just in the aftermath of the earthquake, but in flashbacks too. The novel's prose sometimes strains to capture the intensity of her perspective. I need your father, like hunger, like thirst, she tells Bean as she walks, flashing back to a fight with Dom the day before the earthquake. The terribleness of it fills my entire body, not just this moment, but all of the moments. Her heart is frequently pounding. Often I wanted to grab Annie by the straps of her lavender maternity romper and shout, "What are you doing? Stop walking. Find water and shelter, and protect your baby." Of course, the novel's plot depends upon Annie not doing this, but her decision to keep walking is also indicative of Annie's initial resistance to motherhood and its demands. The ruined city is a crucible through which she passes, a perilous trial, not unlike childbirth itself. While Patti's readers will not get the answer to every question, at the end, Annie will have an answer of her own. All that matters is this ferocious creature she is becoming, a mother, prepared to do whatever she must. The reviewer, Alexis Shatkin, is the author of the novels Elsewhere and Saint X. The Haunting of Room 904 by Erica T. Worth. The book cover shows a door with window blinds throwing shadows on it, and a woman's hand is holding it half open, as if about to step into the room. The reviewer is Toshi Onibuchi. This paranormal investigator's next case, Cracking an Ancient Curse. In The Haunting of Room 904, a woman who can commune with spirits is pulled into a sweeping conspiracy tied to a Native American massacre. Ghosts are business left unfinished, reminders of a wrong that needs righting. They are the unbalanced ledger, and in the United States, unpaid debts never truly die. In Erica T. Worth's novel, The Haunting of Room 904, ghosts appear on page one, and the debt they point to looms large over the entire story. Olivia Vicente, a native paranormal investigator, is hired to break the curse of a hotel room where women, at regular five-year intervals, mysteriously meet violent ends. The case leads her to another tragedy, one that both dwarfs and ties together the individual deaths, the Sand Creek Massacre of 1864. But this summary makes the book sound more serious than it is. What horror exists in these pages is blunted by the novel's persistent tendency towards moralizing. Take, for example, the first exorcism Olivia performs. A young woman who has purchased a daybook box off eBay is subsequently plagued by nightmares and waking visions of her deceased father. A grieving and angry Cheyenne two-spirit presence resides in the box and has sought out the young woman because she is descended from a white person who participated in the massacre that decimated the Cheyenne tribe. How is the malevolent ghost exorcised from the box? Olivia has the young woman apologize for her ancestors' roles in the killings. On top of that, the woman feels compelled then to donate to the American Indian College Fund and to send a formal public apology to the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes on behalf of her ancestor. Problem solved. The Haunting of Room 904 is less horror and more urban fantasy in the mold of Buffy the Vampire Slayer or Charmed, where everyone is young and flirty and humor is deployed liberally. But where the aforementioned TV shows possess structural narrative integrity and characters who took their jobs seriously, this novel abounds in plot holes. Characters hide and reveal information not because it was what they would actually do, but because the story needs tension or because the characters are heading in the wrong direction and the course of their investigation must be righted. Stock figures proliferate. The gay best friend, the mysterious mustache-stroking cult leader, the deceased sibling who serves as fount for the protagonist's unresolved guilt, a cartoonishly evil ex-boyfriend who happens to be one of the richest men in town. Characters act inexplicably, either to aid or to impede our hero, and high-stakes situations act like sticks of dynamite brought to you by the Acme Corporation, never detonating when they're supposed to. Appearing throughout at irregular intervals are scenes from the massacre, as it is called in the narration. The gravity of those scenes jars strongly with the lightness of the rest of the novel, but rather than have the contrast render each aspect of the book more poignant, that contrast only muddles the tone. It's like two family members trying to tell a story together, but one is giggling and the other is on the verge of tears. Reconstructing a horrific episode of American history in dollhouse miniature can make it easier to take in, but more difficult to take seriously. Every time a character seems to signal their virtue or learn the error of their or their ancestors' ways, I feel I'm watching someone whip out an Amex card, as though the debt could be paid so easily. The ghosts deserve better. The reviewer, Toshi Onyebushi, is the author of Goliath, Riot Baby, and the forthcoming books Is This a Race Book? And Harmattan Season. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.